from New Orleans, this is Music Inside Out. I'm Gwen Tompkins. Nadja Salerno Soddenberg is a world-class violinist who was born in Rome, studied at Juilliard, and has enjoyed a more than 30-year career. Along the way, Salerno Soddenberg got chummy with all the usual suspects a violinist on her level needed to know. Schubert, Tchaikovsky, Shostakovich, Kreisler, Johnny Carson, and Captain James T. Kirk of the Starship Enterprise.
And I know it's silly. Please understand that I know that it's silly, but I have a fantasy that William Shatner's my father.
Even her fantasies are extraordinary. Nadja Salerno Soddenberg, after the break. No one looks forward to a hurricane making landfall. But when the hurricane is called Nadja Salerno Soddenberg, get tickets. Nadja Salerno Soddenberg is one of the world's great violinists. As a guest soloist, she's played with an ever-widening variety of dynamic orchestras. She's won some of the world's most coveted prizes for violin, and she's inspired a documentary that was nominated for an Academy Award. Salerno Soddenberg has made more than a dozen albums and created her own label called NSS Music. As a concertmaster and music director, she was a vital force in the rise of the New Century Chamber Orchestra, based in San Francisco. And as a teacher, she guides young artists to relate to music as never before. Nadja Salerno Soddenberg now teaches full-time here at Loyola University's College of Music and Fine Arts. They call her an extraordinary faculty member. And looking back, we call her one of our favorite interviews ever.
Wow, what an opening.
Oh,
hurricane.
Boy.
Thanks.
You are a force of
nature.
Yeah,
I've heard it before.
A force for good.
Yes.
Well, let's start at the beginning. I want to talk about your grandparents.
Wow. Okay.
You know, they are the Salerno and Salerno Soddenberg, and they reportedly raised the bar for what grandparents can do for a child.
Yeah. Well, I was raised by my grandmother because my mother had to go to work. No father around.
And you knew her both in Rome as well as in the United States.
Well, I was born in Rome.
Yes.
And then we kind of migrated. I didn't know why at the time, but it was because of me. And my grandmother was the big influence in my life for life's lessons. And I learned life's lessons while I kept her company while she cooked. It's as if somebody tapped her on the shoulder and reminded her, say something wise that she'll remember. So she would say to me, like in the middle of cooking something, she said, don't put too much garlic in this. And try not to marry a garbage man. Like she'd say something like that. And I'd say, what's wrong with that? She said, well, just try. There's nothing wrong with it, but just try. And then we'd go back to something else. And this was her, like as if she had some responsibility to pearls of wisdom every now and then.
That's pretty dang good, actually. That's a good way of slipping in some of life's wisdom. You're right.
The spirit of this woman was intoxicating. It was everybody wanted to be in the room with her.
Amazing.
So this was a huge influence on me, my grandmother. And my grandfather. musically was an enormous influence because he introduced opera to me. And that's the biggest influence of my life.
Yes, yes. And I want you to talk a little bit about that. I mean, I love opera. And I've found that in talking to musicians, almost irrespective of genre, you know, jazz musicians, other rock and roll musicians, they almost always mention opera as like a source of major inspiration, catharsis.
Mm-hmm. It has everything. I think maybe that's one of the reasons. For me, it's got the orchestra, so you've got orchestral music, and you've got the glory of the human voice. Then you've got a plot, a story, right. Scenery. It's like HD entertainment, you know? But for me, it was because it was just so happened that my grandfather was an opera freak, and he introduced it to me. And every Saturday, the radio would present live from the Met, and you'd hear whatever opera that was.
What's so interesting is that the whole family seemed to have a real relationship with music. Your mother with the piano, your brother who's a singer, or who sang at the time.
Singer, cellist, pianist.
Wow.
Yeah, wildly talented.
And your grandmother, Roshi, played kazoo.
Your
grandfather played trumpet.
My grandfather was an extraordinary trumpet player.
Mm.
Extraordinary. To this day, I don't know anybody who can sight read music like my grandfather did. Like you could put a score, an orchestral score of Penderecki in front of him. This is a man from a teeny town in Sicily.
Now, the thing is, someone put a violin into your hands, but do you ever think to yourself about what maybe you would have liked to have had a crack at another instrument?
Voice. I'm singing.
Yeah?
Violin would not have been my first choice, but here's how that happened. We were in Italy, and just as we've been talking about, the family's very musical. And I'm the youngest, so I was 4 or 5 years old without an instrument. My brother was playing, everybody, you know, Italian family, also very relatable here in this city. You invite people over for dinner, it's casual, you eat a lot, then you go in the other room and you make music. Talk, eat some more, and make music. That's what was going on, and I was the only one who wasn't participating.
Mm-hmm.
So a friend of my mom said, you know, maybe she might get a complex. I don't think I would have gotten a complex, but maybe you should give her something to play. And at the time, my mom, she had a very, very good friend in Rome who was kind of moonlighting violinist, giving lessons to beginners. So she thought, perfect, let me do this. It's a chance for me to see my friend. We sit down, we catch up.
Mm-hmm.
And there's an instrument for my daughter to play. So that's how it started. It was no thought like I thought I heard it and I must play this. And absolutely not.
But boy, maybe you could have been a singer.
Maybe.
Do you sing now?
No.
In the shower?
I mean, I sing well for somebody who doesn't sing. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
Not opera. I couldn't do that.
To keep yourself company?
I mean, that would have been my first choice.
Yeah.
My absolute first choice. But
you know, the Marsalises, Ellis Marsalis, he had so many sons, but he refused to allow two sons to play the same instrument.
Right. Smart.
And so I wonder if maybe that's how your folks were when it came to singing, because as you say, your brother was, among other things, a singer,
mm-hmm.
right?
I think it was because her friend was teaching violin. I think if her friend was teaching the clarinet, I probably wouldn't be on the show right now. But
no, you'd be on the show, but you'd just be on with a different instrument. But let me ask you this. I mean, you did make this crossing with your family at the age of 8. You came to the States. You went to Philadelphia. Were you aware at the time that all of this was for you, that everybody's packing up and heading off and, you know, moving to a whole new country, new city, new house, everything, and that you were at the center of this?
Absolutely not. I was 8. I don't think I could have absorbed it. What could an 8-year-old understand of this? Why? What?
Exactly.
No, I had no knowledge at all. But I did come to this country on a boat with my grandmother.
I love that. I love that.
That was, I still remember it.
You didn't have like an Ellis Island moment.
No. We came on the SS Michelangelo.
Okay.
We had bunk bed. It was just a magic week. It took a week to cross the Atlantic.
Fantastic. Yeah. Fantastic. And so, but as a child, there have to have been some hints. I mean, you have to have heard people whispering in the background, well, that Nadia, maybe she's pretty good. Or just seeing the looks on people's faces when they heard you
play.
No,
honestly, no.
Really?
No, because I was not a kind of child protege where I picked up the violin and I was playing Mendelssohn concerto in 2 weeks. It was just as simple as this. Genetically, I was predisposed to being musical. That's my family. The teacher at the time saw that, spotted that, knew that I had good intonation. I had an ear. Like if I played a note out of tune, I knew it was out of tune. So, you know, that I could hear things like that and that I was also very naturally musical. So when you have, a small kid like that, you have to recognize, well, this is something that you should probably pursue if you want to. So I had no idea of that. I mean, and I wasn't like, you know, blowing anybody away. I was playing little baby pieces, but I was playing them musically and I was playing them in tune. And I was very emotional even back then when I played these silly little baby pieces.
Really?
Yeah.
Yes. You know, I read your book, Nadia on My Way, which is...
You did?
It is in my bag right now.
It's 20 minutes and you threw that book. That's a children's book.
I know, but of course, you know, for me, I was riveted. And I thought to myself, is this a comment on my level of maturity or what? You know, but I love that. Wait, hold up.
Where did you even get it?
You know, it took a while.
eBay,
let me
right?
tell
something
you.
Like, oh, yeah, my God, there it is.
That's Nadia a very... on my way.
Yeah, you do have it.
It's a good book. It's a good read, kids. All right. And in your book, you know, you're very self-effacing. But at the same time, you talked, I thought, very movingly about playing with your mother for the first time.
Mm-hmm. Chartus.
Chartus.
Yes, a little, written for beginning violin.
Mm-hmm.
But it happened to have piano accompaniment. I mean, we're talking basic. We're talking about harmonies that are like Mississippi hot dog, Mississippi. You know, that's the kind of piece it was. A lot of open strings, but it had harmony. And so to me, it was like opera. That was revelatory. Then I was like, oh my God, this is going to be great. You know, instead of just practicing.
Let me ask you this. When you think about I don't know how much you remember about Rome, but when you think about your place back in Philadelphia, growing up in that house.
I grew up in Cherry Hill, New Jersey.
Oh, in Cherry Hill.
My mother grew up in Philadelphia. My grandparents immigrated and they lived in Philadelphia. I was born in Rome and I went from Rome, Italy to Cherry Hill, New Jersey.
Gotcha.
Little bit of a culture shock.
That
just
I believe.
Just a little bit.
So there you are in Cherry Hill, New Jersey.
Yes.
New. Everything is new. But at the same time, you make a life for yourself as a young person.
I was excited to come to America. In Italy... The Americans, we called them Yankees. So I absorbed the culture and found there was a team called the Yankees. Oh, my gosh, forget about it. So a whole new world that I couldn't wait to get to know and absorb.
Exactly.
And I learned how to speak English by watching. Okay, this is crazy. But one has stayed with me for my whole life. Star Trek.
That is so my
Star
favorite
Trek,
show.
Star Trek. I mean, I just, to this day, I just met William Shatner.
You did not.
I'm digressing. I'm sorry.
No, I want to hear this.
I just met William Shatner.
What was it like?
I have to say that because I've never met my father, I have this, and I know it's silly. Please understand that I know that it's silly, but I have a fantasy that William Shatner's my father.
Yeah.
And I figured it could be anybody. Since I never met him, it could be anybody. There was a Star Trek convention recently in New York, and he was going to be there. I was not well. I was sick, but I thought, I mean, I think he might be 86, 87 years old. You get down there, you meet this man, you shake his hand, you thank him, and you take a picture with him, and it is my proudest possession.
Oh.
It was like, I can't believe I met William Shatner. Silly.
It's wonderful. I was a Leonard Nimoy fan.
Yes.
Oh, my word. I wanted to be Mr. Spock. Then I wanted to marry Mr. Spock.
Yeah.
Then I just wanted to work around Mr. Spock.
Yeah.
Then I wanted us to date steady for a while.
Oh,
you know,
see.
I wanted everything.
Yeah, I just wanted to work on the Enterprise with my dad.
Oh.
I'd like work in engineering or something, but I knew he was up there captaining the ship.
when you think back to this house on Cherry Hill, in Cherry Hill, New Jersey, what did it sound like? If you had to think of a soundscape as you were growing up, what would the sounds be?
I heard things that I had not heard in Rome. The crack of a baseball bat. I heard the language constantly around me. I heard bubbles popping, you know, chewing gum, bubble gum. I heard television, American, everything, American music, American songs. It sounded American, and I absorbed it all.
Are there any pieces of music that you hear today when you think to yourself, this is transporting me right back to Cherry Hill? I am back in my house in Cherry Hill.
Scheherazade. Because it was an album that was there, I thought it was the greatest piece ever written. And I listened to it over and over and over again. Unfortunately, right next to the speaker, which did some damage to my left ear. But that, I mean, just that piece was, I felt like I was in another world with that piece. I was very, very, very young. Of course, later in life, I learned more music and I realized, hey, Mahler's great. You know, but for me, that there was nothing greater, grander, bigger, more mystical, more exciting, more romantic, more beautifully harmonic. Nothing. It just was the greatest piece for me. Rimsky-Korsakov, Scheherazade.
There's something so charming about thinking about a little girl, mm-hmm. you know, sitting with her ear to the speaker listening to Scheherazade.
And I'll tell you what, there was one other piece that mm-hmm. brings me back to my youth, even earlier than my time in the United States. This is my time in Italy.
Yes.
It was a Christmas there, and my aunt came over, and she brought me up my Christmas present. And I don't know why they decided, but it was a little contraption called a mangiadischi. And the direct translation is eats the discs. It will eat the disc. So it was a little record player, which was like sort of oblong. And I got this, it was orange. And you just put the little record in there and you press one button and it plays it. And guess what the record was?
What?
Okay, now you have to, I was maybe 5-6 years old. This is the record that my family decided would be good for me to have. Frank Sinatra, Strangers in the Night. So there I am. Doobie, doobie, doo. I know that song where. Doo, 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 dee, da, da. You know, that's what I listen to over and over again. So when I hear Scheherazade or when I hear Strangers in the Night, I am totally transported back to my.
Exchanging glances.
Exchanging glances.
Wandering in the night. What were the chances we'd be sharing love? Before the night was through.
Oh, that's a good one. That's a really good
but
song,
why
actually.
Would a family give a 5-year-old that song?
Well, for the same reason why a family gives a 5-year-old a birthday party. It's not really for the 5-year-old. The 5-year-old couldn't care less.
I guess.
They're giving it. They want to hear it themselves. They want their own party, you know?
Right.
You are a Frank Sinatra delivering device.
I've always loved Sinatra.
Strangers in the night. Two lonely people, we were strangers in the night. Up to the moment when we said our first hello. Little did we know, love was just a glance away. A warm embracing dance away. And ever since that night, we've been together, lovers at first sight. In love forever, it turned out so right. For strangers in the night.
That's Frank Sinatra with Strangers in the Night. This is a rebroadcast of our conversation with Nadja Salerno Sonnenberg. Coming up, The Cruelest Cut. Stay tuned. We're listening to the fourth and last movement of the E major sonata by Bach with Anne-Marie McDermott on piano and our guest, Nadja Salerno Sonnenberg on violin.
¶¶
like one of the world's great violins, from what I can tell.
It's a good violin.
It's look at you.
It's not one of the world's great violins, honestly. No, but it's a very good violin. Yeah.
Okay, it was made in 1721.
Right.
It's 2016.
It's used.
It's gotta be kind of good, right?
I gotta get a new one of these days. It's used. Yes, but it's good. It's very good.
But you're not a violin head in that sense. You're not trying to look for...
Never have been.
You know, the Stradivarius, the whatever.
Right. Well, I have a Guarnerius, so it's a wonderful violin. But, you know, there are people... Look, it's whatever rocks your boat. There are people that just, you know, covet an instrument because it's famous or because of a certain sound or whatever, and they buy it, and then they sell it and buy another one, and their whole life is, you know, that's their hobby.
Yeah.
And it is so not mine.
Right.
I mean, just not interesting to me at all. I think this is a violin, this is my violin, that's it.
But you said you once called it naughty.
It looks naughty. My violin, the varnish on my violin, it looks naughty. If it were alive, it would definitely be doing something illegal. That's what I think my violin looks like. Looks naughty.
Your violin is a con artist.
Yeah. Yeah.
Now, in your book, Nadja on My Way, you say that nothing about the violin is natural, comfortable, or easy or graceful, right?
Mm-hmm.
So how do you make friends with your instrument?
Well, for me, first place, it wasn't a choice of mine. For me, as in anything, when something is challenging or even negative, difficult, if you can spot what is great about it, you know, it's the same make lemonade kind of, you know, that's what it is. And the repertoire for the violin is vast. It's really, really, really big. That was a great thing. I loved that it can encompass the absolute gamut of sounds. You know, you've got the vibrato. That's something the piano cannot do. As great as a piano is, you know, no vibrato, no. So I just decided that this is a great instrument and everything that's really hard about it, I'm just not going to think about that because, again, here's the reward. I'm all about reward.
You know, it is endlessly fascinating to me how you're able to conjure the intentions of the dead.
Hmm.
I mean, on some level, that's what you're doing.
Mm-hmm.
This person has written a missive that has reached your hands. And, you know, no matter how specific that person was or, you know, I mean, on paper, there's still an act of faith that's happening between this composer.
Right.
Of course, there are many living composers we have to, of course, acknowledge. But between this composer and you.
Mm-hmm.
And so how, when you play, how important is it to know the composer's story, to know the composer's life? Is that important to understanding the intent of the piece?
You want me to be honest?
Yes.
No.
Wow.
Not at all. Is it a good thing to do? Absolutely. And sometimes it informs the music. But if you have musical instinct, you have musical instinct, period, the end. And I don't need to see on paper when I see, you know, something like... That's the vamp. And I come in with... I know what to do with that. I don't need to see what the tempo marking is. I don't need to see the... dynamic marking. I don't need to say con espressive. I don't need to see that. But I have golden, very strong musical instincts. I don't need to see that to know, because isn't that obvious when you hear that? Harmonic, isn't it obvious that this is from so far away, this entrance? However, I'll just give you an example.
Mm-hmm.
I played Brahms Violin Concerto my whole life. I recorded it. I was lucky to play this piece. One of the most frustrating things about the Brahms Violin Concerto in the second movement, the slow movement, gorgeous movement, is that the violin soloist never gets to play the theme. It's a bit odd, isn't it? I mean, a violin concerto that never plays the theme. So, you have a jazz singer singing
verses,
anything, and never sing the tune.
Right.
So isn't that crazy?
Mm-hmm.
So Brahms was in love with Clara Schumann,
yes,
who was married to his teacher. So you just got to picture this. He goes over, you know, to the house and gets his lesson every week, sees Clara, covets, broken heart, never going to get her because they had a wonderful marriage.
The Schumanns.
Yes, the Schumanns. I look at that. It's not written in any book. Nobody told me this. But when I learned about this, I thought, I wonder if this movement isn't some sort of homage to his love that will never be and will never die. So it's frustrating for the soloist not to play the theme. The oboe has it. The oboe starts. The oboe in the orchestra plays it for a long time. The violin solo comes in, plays three notes of it. Without any knowledge of whether this is correct or not, I decided, just like I decided William Shatner's my dad, I decided that this was Brahms's screaming pain, so not ever having her, and the frustration of that. It's just pain.
Yes. Something that's always just eluding the grasp.
Exactly, exactly.
Yes. I'm not the first one to tell you. I'm not the millionth person to tell you this. I mean, but obviously you play it in a very emotive way. Mm-hmm. When I see you tear, I'm wondering, you know, are you thinking about the composer or are you thinking about, some other aspect of your own experience or of a universal experience?
The answer is I'm not thinking. I'm just feeling.
You know, I like the way your mother describes it, you know, in that 1999 documentary, Speaking in Strings, that you did, beautiful documentary. And your mother, Josephine, she says, I'm mimicking her because she's got such a great accent. It seems to cleanse. It's like confession.
Yeah, that almost sounds like her. That's great.
And that made sense. Mm-hmm. That's catharsis.
Yeah, well, she's right. I mean, it, music has, to play it, to hear it, to feel it has saved my life more than once.
But, you know, and I don't want to dwell on this, but at the same time, people have complained about it, you know, about your approach, at least, particularly when you were just coming out. Mm-hmm. And how long did it take for people to just kind of calm down?
Until they found somebody else to pick on, really. It was like 30 years, honestly. And I noticed, you know, I learned so much in my years. I noticed how the press follows what the last person wrote, then that goes into your press kit. That gets mailed to the next interview, and they say the same things, they ask you the same questions. And
yes.
It goes clear across the country. To be fair to the press, I mean, I was a little bit of an oddity, so I get that. I understand. But what I resented was that because of my popularity, because I sat there and kind of bantered with Johnny Carson,
yes,
the impression was she's not serious. And nobody was more serious about music, and nobody practiced more than I did because I had to.
But one thing that you wrote in, I think it might have been in a letter, you said something that it just seemed to be right on the money. Emotional playing without meaning is pointless.
Mm-hmm. I think it's not just playing. I think in any sense, if you're just going to be effusive about something and not be sincere, I think that's the word, the sincerity behind it. You can spot it. It's fake as hell, you know?
That was my next question. Can the audience tell the difference?
I think so. you can reach people through sincerity. I think they can spot it and spot when it's not there.
That's interesting.
Yeah.
But that was one of the great things about the Johnny Carson show, the Tonight Show, because, you know, they looked for people in all different fields who would blow your hair back, no matter how much you knew or how little you knew.
Would you welcome, please, Nadja Salerno Sonnenberg.
That man was a class act.
Yes.
I wasn't by no means the only classical artist he had.
I watched the Carson show religiously.
Mm-hmm.
And when you came on, it was one of those moments when, you know, you yelled to everybody in the house, Nadja's on.
Oh, my God. That you were the only, you and my mom were the only person who were excited.
You started at 5, right?
Yeah.
I read in that article.
Mm-hmm.
Your mother was Italian.
Yeah.
Right? Your father
still
was
Russian.
Still is. Still is.
And I'll tell you the best part of doing that show, makeup. Because I sat in makeup and talked to Johnny Carson personally.
Really?
Before the show, yeah.
What did he say? What did you
say? You know, believe it or not, he admired me. I think he admired the fact that there was this young person and that I was not a lazy kid. That I worked hard and I fought my way up. And I think he admired that so much about me. And then he and I clicked. We just got along when we could talk to each other so easily. I think for him, because he was hell-bent on representing the arts on his show, but how it was like icing on the cake that we really got along, loved each other.
Oh. Now, okay, let me ask you this. Now, this is a sort of a different question, which is, do you mind talking about your finger?
No, not at all.
Okay, 1994, Christmas Day? You are doing what every person on the planet is probably doing, which is cutting vegetables for,
yes, cooking.
You know, for dinner. And then you end up, what?
I had a bunch of people over just to hang out. We'd open presents. They were watching the game. The stereo had Christmas music on. I was in the kitchen, hectic kind of cooking, trying to get everything ready, you know, 15 dishes in 1 hour. And I was slicing onions, and I sliced the tip of my left pinky finger off. I was going too fast. I was going so fast. And, well, that was quite a moment for a violinist.
Yes.
Went into shock. My system went into shock, although it was bleeding a lot.
Yeah.
Just like a bad horror movie.
Right.
Just spurting out of my finger. It's funny. I'm told that what I kept saying over and over again, two things: I'll never play again, who's going to pay the bills? I'll never play again, who's going to pay the bills?
Yeah.
This was what, like, but of like chanting it in the end.
Yeah.
Yeah.
But by virtue of the fact that we're sitting here today,
uh-huh.
You know what I mean? This is a terrible period in your life that you got through.
It was a bad moment, and it was combined later with a lot of emotional stuff that was building and building. So, yeah, tough, tough time. You know, when you put it all together, that I couldn't play the violin, that I decided that I wouldn't accept that, and I started playing again with three fingers. And then everything else emotionally that was going on, you know, I mean, it was just, I was way overworked, spent entirely too much time alone. This didn't work out. That relationship didn't work. I mean, I just felt like I was a kind of playing machine that serviced everybody but myself. I didn't know what to do. It was a hard, hard time. Yeah.
Over time, you did. I mean, the idea that you refingered Tchaikovsky and you refingered all of your, you know what I mean, your repertoire is just incredible to me, right? But
to me, too. I do not know how I played Tchaikovsky violin concerto with three fingers. God, I never hope I have to do that again.
I agree. All right. And you got the finger at the tip reattached. You know, you kept it attached. But then what's so interesting is that I read that you got a skin graft so that you no longer even have a scar.
Right. It was grafted from my toe. So I actually have a different fingerprint on that finger. I could have been like done illegal stuff. And
that's
then
so
they're
cool.
Like, get to fingerprints. No, it's not her.
That is fantastic.
Yeah, yeah.
You have wasted an opportunity to become a cat burglar.
You're absolutely right. At least with one finger.
Exactly. I could have. That would have been. Oh, wow. But the thing about it is that every great artist that I have ever read about, seen, or talked to, they talk about depression. Every one of them. Without exception.
It's a common, isn't it?
Without exception.
Liquor, you know, depression, yeah.
Yeah, I mean, even Bob Dylan in his autobiography, Chronicles, he talks about a hand injury, a terrible hand injury, which he felt like as if he could never play guitar again. And, you know, I mean, the depression that thrust him into. When you experience something like that, do the fans become important at a moment like that? When people write to you to talk to you about how important your music is to them?
Yeah, they are. But I'm always surprised at fans. I'm always surprised, first place, that anybody knows who I am or that they know my work. I'm always surprised at how emotional they are with me sometimes. And then I think to myself, well, don't be surprised. You know, you're a very instinctive, emotional player, and you are able to convey that. So of course they're gonna receive that. But I'm just so grateful and shocked at the reaction that my playing or my career or my life or my friendship or who I am has on the effect it has on other people. It is still surprising to me, and it's humbling.
It really, I have to say, I mean, I feel like as if I've been hovering over your shoulder, because I went on your website and there's a Q&A function on your website where you can go through and read some of the letters that you've gotten, and you've gotten some pretty interesting ones. I did bring along two letters that I just personally love, and I want you to read them. Because if I were really down and somebody wrote me a letter like these, then I would feel a little bit better that day.
Oh my gosh. Yes, right away I remember this one. Dear Miss Salerno Sonnenberg, as part of the U.S. Antarctic Research Program, I spent a total of 3 trips to the ice. The second trip I wintered over, spending 13 months straight, no mall, no phone, no TV, from February 5th to November 9th. As a South Pole station manager, one of my more important jobs was to pay close attention to morale and build a team of an internationally diverse group of people. I had Chinese, Russian, Norwegian scientists, among others. Not all spoke fluent English. Music being a constant to all, I created the Naja Hour. I remember this letter. I'm so susceptible to these things now. Every Sunday from February to November, after the evening meal and chores were completed, the group got together in our small common room and settled in, got comfortable, and listened to one of your albums. All 13 of us are now avid Naja fans for life. This hour with your music brought us together and helped us deal with the isolation, missing families, and gave us a common bond that I feel will last for life. Thank you very much for your music. And remember, you have fans who appreciate you all the way to the actual geographic South Pole. We left your music at the pole for future crews to appreciate, and I'm sure they will. With respect and gratitude, R. Gibson. It was very hard for me to do. Don't make me do another one.
Okay, I won't make you do another one.
I remember that. Let me see the other one you have.
Okay.
Yeah, it's always, you know, it's these people. I'm such a, yeah, this one was deployed, yeah. Do you want me to read it or
I would love it if you would.
All right, I'll give it a shot. But I start crying, that's the problem. Okay, here we go. Dear Miss Salerno Sonnenberg, I do not play the violin, but I do appreciate the instrument very much. I was brought up in a musical family, and while I did play the trumpet, and I do play the guitar, the only violinist I ever enjoyed before you were Yasha Heifetz and Itzhak Perlman. Suffice it to say, somewhere in the 1980s, I saw you on the Johnny Carson show, and my appreciation changed. I said to my wife, now there's a girl with passion. And when I was deployed, I confess your music was the only thing that could make me cry, or more appropriately, the only thing I allowed myself to cry over. The funny thing was that after several nights playing your CDs, I would have a gaggle of 18 or 19-year-old boys in my hooch literally begging me to play the classical stuff by that girl. You should be impressed. Most were death metal addicts or gangster rap fans. For me and for the boys, thank you. Christopher Mitchell, Sergeant First Class, U.S. Army, retired. I got another, you know, I remember getting a fan letter from a helicopter pilot. Such a beautiful letter. And he sent me his dog tag. I still have it. Of course I have it. You know what? That dog tag is, it's on the cover of one of my albums.
Is that right? Yeah. Wow. That's
I have a
wonderful.
Real soft spot for the armed forces too. I mean, God bless them.
And the fact that you can bring them comfort, that's the thing. That's what's so exciting, I would imagine, as an artist, that you know that because people are telling you so, that you are bringing comfort to people in the far corners of the earth at a time when they need it
most. It's surprising because I'm a classical violinist. And yet you can just picture those 18 people in the South Pole. Oh, God. You know, listening to my music? I totally expect them to listen to Sinatra, but my music? It's wonderful.
We're listening to Nadja Salerno Sonnenberg play Mendelssohn's Violin Concerto in E minor. Coming up, if a chamber orchestra has no conductor, then who's the boss? Stay with us. I'm Gwen Tompkins, and this is a rebroadcast of Music Inside Out. This is the New Century Chamber Orchestra performing Swillig's Il Capitano from Commedia dell'arte. Our guest, Nadja Salerno Sonnenberg, was music director of the San Francisco-based organization for 9 seasons. She's now on faculty at Loyola University here in New Orleans. She teaches a new way forward in classical music.
Century Chamber Orchestra is a conductor-less orchestra, mm-hmm. which is becoming, I'm hearing, more and more common. Is that right?
More than it used to be, yeah. Absolutely. It's a vibrant, wonderful way to make music.
But it reminds me of the Headless Horseman of Sleepy Hollow. I mean...
Thanks.
Well, you know, in the sense of, like, there's nobody in charge.
No, there is somebody in charge. But... just think about it. You don't have the person beating the time up there in front. How do these musicians play together?
Yeah, how do they do it?
I don't know. How do we do it? Tell me. How do we do it?
A one and a two.
I don't know. How do we do it? It's impossible. Obviously, it's not impossible. But so you're talking about the responsibility of each of those musicians. You cannot slack back there and just look up to see that beat.
Thank you.
If it doesn't feel together, you better have some eye contact to figure out why. Where is this going? Well, I'm the leader. I'm sitting there. You know, I'm the hurricane, like you said.
You are the
hurricane. It's going somewhere. Don't worry about it. So I feel like what all the musicians on stage have like hoses that are attached to my body, just sapping everything out. They go with that energy because it's so strong. Of course it's possible. And it is the highest form of music making. I'm addicted to it. I love it. And I'm so happy to be doing that here.
Oh, I love that.
Yeah, really happy.
And so when you go into Loyola, you know, to see these students who have been just awaiting you and, you know, afraid of you and at the same time wanting to impress you, how do you get them into this mindset?
If you have the ability and the knowledge to make these students play better than they think they can play and enjoy it more than they think they can enjoy it, and you don't do it, it's criminal. So within three rehearsals, you can see it in their face. You can see it in their posture, their confidence. Like, oh, hell, I can play this. Whoa, I can play this. And then once you teach them how to play it, then you teach them how to play it with vibrancy, with sincerity, with emotion, mm-hmm. and excitement.
Let me ask you this. Could you teach a kid with your instincts and with your toughness and with your sass, but hellfire comes when you meet your very self in a little kid who is just like you?
Mm-hmm. I have not met this student yet.
According to your book, you know, Nadja, On My Way, you were not the easiest student. Right. You had this wonderful teacher, Dorothy DeLay, over at Juilliard, right?
I was rebellious as a student because I didn't want to do what the teacher wanted, but I was also curious. I was always asking why. So, I mean, if a kid came in and played for me and I told them, you're never going to play that well if your thumb is not in position, and they said to me, why? I'd love that, because that means automatically that's already interest is there. The great thing about Dorothy DeLay was that she was able to teach each of her students according to their personality. So she manipulated me. And I call it benevolent manipulation, because you know more than this person because you're 50 years older than this person, and you can see the character and you can see the personality of this person. And in order for this kid to reach his or her potential, you're going to have to work this. You can't just say, this is how you're going to play well and this is how you're going to feel good about playing. It's not going to work.
Right.
You have to manipulate them. It works. Everybody wants to be inspired and sometimes needs to be inspired. I think that's what I can bring, because I've always been inspired by it. And I think mm-hmm. that's what I can bring to this time in my life where I have to share this with a younger generation. I have to share this amazing knowledge that I have. I must rid myself of it. I feel like it's a virus. I got to get rid of it. I have so much knowledge, you know, decades of experience, and if I can inspire, then I've got to do it. It's the most rewarding work I've ever done.
Is there anything that you'd like to learn that you don't already know? A violin piece or?
Oh God, no. I've played a lot of violin music. You know what I'd love to do? Because I played trumpet for a very small period of my life, mm-hmm. and I love that instrument, always have, because it was, you know, it goes back to my grandfather. I just love the trumpet and, you know, New Orleans and
yes.
that kind of, yeah. I would love to get my horrible chops back and just join a very bad marching band.
That is an amazing idea.
Well, there'd be like, you know, these fantastic marching bands that are all over the place here. And then there'll be that one like senior citizen lady in the back there. What the hell is she doing in that marching band? I just would love that. That's the kind of stuff I want to do now. You know why? Because I've worked so hard my whole life and I want to enjoy things. I just want to have my little toot toot part in the back there and be with the rest of the band. That would make me so happy. I'm gonna work on it.
Nadja Salerno-Sonnenberg, you've been awfully kind. You've been awfully generous with your time, and I just am thrilled that you were able to come and spend some time with us here at Music Inside Out.
You are an amazing woman, full of amazing experience, and this has been, and let me tell you something, there have been so many, the most gratifying interview I've ever done. Thank you.
Oh, boy. That's tall talk. That's amazing.
It's true.
Well, thank you. Thank you. Just hear her in the Dirty Dozen Brass Band? And you've been listening to Music Inside Out. Our show is produced by Lynette Johnson, Paul McDonald, Jason Ryan, Garrett Pittman, and Thomas Pierce. Music Inside Out is produced in partnership with WWNO. For a complete playlist of the music in this hour, go to our website at musicinsideout.org. I'm Gwen Tompkins, and this is Music Inside Out.
Major support for Music Inside Out comes from the Historic New Orleans Collection. Music Inside Out also receives support from the Ruth U. Fertel Foundation, the New Orleans Jazz and Heritage Foundation, the Pinkalope Foundation, Baba Jim Istanbul Studios and Mastering, Adam Newman Designs, Shop Nadine Blake, and WWNO. Donations to Music Inside Out are tax deductible, thanks to our partnership with National Performance Network. For more information about how you can support our program, please go to our website at musicinsideout.org/support.